Welcome to Tastes of the Tropics. And now, here are your hosts, Gretchen Schmidt and Christina Favretto.
Welcome to Tastes of the Tropics. This is Gretchen Schmidt of Edible South Florida.
And this is Christina Favretto of University of Miami Special Collections.
And I want to start out today by saying last night I stopped by my Publix to pick up some cat food. Earlier in the day, I went by our Milam's Markets because they have really good baguette there. Christina?
Yesterday, I considered going to either Whole Foods, which is closer to where I work, or Publix myself. I just needed milk and decided against because the lines, et cetera, were just too daunting on a Friday evening. So I went milkless today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking today with someone who's just written a wonderful book. He's written many wonderful books, but it's really a love letter, informative part, reflections on the grocery store. Welcome, Michael Ruhlman.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
First of all, tell us a little bit. When I read the story, I thought, oh, I'm going to learn all the ins and outs of grocery stores that we shoppers don't necessarily know about product placement. But that really wasn't what this was about at all, was it?
No, I found that to be the least interesting part of the story, or at least part of that. And I'll get to that later. I would like to talk about this perception we have, that you have. But this is really, as you said, a love letter to grocery stores. I've always liked grocery stores. And my dad always loved grocery stores. And after he died, I started looking into grocery stores to see why they fascinated so much. And I realized what an amazing institution they are. What an astonishing thing it is to have such abundance of relatively inexpensive, safe, nutritious food, pretty much 24/7 here in America. We're so lucky, and we take them for granted. We don't even think about it. We just expect them to be there. I don't think we should. I think we should make sure they're as good as they possibly can be, because if you don't live near a grocery store, you're more likely to be sick, you're more likely to be fat, you're more likely to have diet-related illnesses, and you're more likely to die sooner.
You make an interesting point about the way grocery stores are tied into prosperity in the United States as opposed to other countries. And yet in Italy, where they now have large grocery stores, there is still a habit, and also in France and in Germany, of going to specialty stores for individual items. So what do you attribute this American love of ease and fast shopping as opposed to the Europeans' willingness to kind of multitask when it comes to shopping?
Well, it's kind of representative of our whole consumer culture. I mean, it really began with the AMP back in the late 1700s, and they became the biggest retailer on the planet for a long time, up and through the 1920s. They were the biggest retailer ever. They were the Walmart of their day, and they were maligned as Walmart was maligned for decimating Main Street. But they were the ones who ushered in more for less and selling food by volume. These guys made it happen. And once we had that, then it was the more for less ethos in America. And, you know, then so we had the AMPs. They started out just selling groceries, meaning shelf-stable goods. They didn't sell greens. They didn't sell dairy. But eventually, other grocers said, oh, well, let's sell greens, let's sell dairy. And then in the 1930s, once refrigeration was financially feasible for stores, we could have everything under one roof. And that's what happened when Michael Cullen in Jamaica, Queens opened the first grocery store, the first supermarket, first one that had all categories in under one roof, had dairy, had fish, meat, produce, and grocery under one roof. And then it grew from there. And then there's all kinds of other social forces, the World War, the automobile, the highway system, the flight out to the suburbs. And suddenly our grocery stores were massive, 30,000 square foot buildings filled with 7,000, 10,000 products. And now it's 90,000 square feet, or 100,000 square feet, and 50,000 products. So that's how we grew.
I love the book because you also bring up a lot of issues that most people don't think about the development of the paper bag and cardboard boxes for packing and how that all factors in. And it's been this step-by-step rise to these palaces we have now of goods. And also, I really like how you tell of your father's love for grocery shopping.
Well, thank
most
you.
Of us don't love to grocery shop.
No, we think of it as a chore. But if we thought about it as something that we were very fortunate to have, I think that would help the chore-ness of going to the grocery store. I'm so glad you brought up the paper bag and the cardboard box and the cheap tin can, because those really were revolutionary forces. Before then, people, store clerks, just dumped a shovel into a bucket of flour or a barrel of flour, poured it into a bag. The first box product was baking powder, which so many people used because we baked a lot of bread. We did a lot of quick breads, and so it was a very popular item. By an accident, a paper bag maker found out that you could make a cardboard box that was inexpensive. And once you had a cardboard box, you could also put a label on that, and you could enclose stuff, so it gave the impression of consistency, cleanliness, and it was marketable. It had a brand on the box. Once tin cans, which had been around since Napoleon's age, it became very cheap to can stuff. Another enclosed item that you could put a label on. This is when the grocery market took off. Before then, A&P was kind of just more a coffee, tea, and sugar store. Once they get brand products and their own branded product, that's when they could really take off. So the cardboard box and the tin can is what made grocery stores and the supermarket possible.
They run the repeats of Charles Schulz's Peanuts in the Sunday paper in the comics. And it's sort of, you know, they're very timeless in their topics, but there was one in the last week where Snoopy was playing a cashier. And I read it out of habit until I realized it was really dated, because he said he's greeting the customer and he's like, "Do you have any bottles today?" And I remembered that you used to bring your bottles. We don't have returning bottles here in Florida. Okay. You do, and that would deduct from your, you know, because you gotta, you know.
That's right.
And the friendliness of greeting customers by names. Now, Michael, does this still happen in the bigger chains today that you see, or have they become sort of homogenized as the Walmarts become suddenly our grocery stores for many people, and even Whole Foods for that matter?
It depends on the place. I mean, the smart ones, especially the independent grocers, and like the Publix here in Florida, which I love the Publix grocery stores, most of them, if they're run by good people and realize that customer service and the feeling that you have when you're shopping there matters for repeat business, then yeah, you're going to have that same experience. If they don't ask you, did you find everything you need, there's something wrong. And they ask you that because they found that people won't come back if they don't have, if store didn't have everything they need. So when they ask you that, they really mean it. They're not just saying that. They will help you find their this product, whatever it is, because their margins are so slim. It's a 1% margin this business runs on. Most businesses are 10% or higher. 10% is kind of the bottom line as far as feasibility goes. Grocery stores, 1.25 margin. So that means basically if you make $500 million a year, as this one grocery store that I followed in Cleveland, if you do that in sales, that means you have a profit of $5 million. Which isn't a lot to cover sways in pricing and redeveloping stores and investing in infrastructure and all that. So it's a very precarious business.
That was an amazing fact. That really stuck out at me. And I lived in Los Angeles. I moved here from there. And I would remember when I moved there thinking I'm in this gigantic city. But after three visits to my Trader Joe's, my neighborhood Trader Joe's, they knew me. And I also found out that they took the "Did you find everything you need" very seriously, because I'd often slow down the line if I said, "What about that chocolate with the hazelnuts?" So, and it seems like such a simple idea, yet no, I don't see that happening here in Miami that much. So what do you attribute that to? Just bad training of your employees, the fact that you can't retain employees, maybe there's not enough?
I would say that's the manager of the store and whoever manages the group of stores. If it's a single family owned grocery store, normal sized grocery store, then that's just bad business. So I don't know why. It varies. But, you know, in every profession, you've got the very good and the very bad, and most everybody's in between, and that's what you're talking about.
What were some of those things that your father and you remember about grocery stores back then? Something that's different from what our experience today.
Well, back then, again, we only had 7,000 products, say, on the store. We didn't have 30 different kinds of apples to choose from. We didn't. There was no such thing as bagged lettuce back then. That's a new. That's a relatively new development starting in the 1980s. So you had head lettuce, and they sold tons of head lettuce, and maybe a few heart sturdier greens, but that was it. In Cleveland, you didn't get blueberries in the wintertime. You got them in the summertime, which is when they grow in North America. So it was much more seasonal, but it was also not as good. You know, we had access to all kinds of meat, but when you look at what we have access to now, we have hormone-free, antibiotic-free beef, we have organic chicken, we have 15 different kinds of eggs. The dairy shelves have exploded with stuff. They were trying to shrink back in the 70s, shrink their dairy, because dairy was all bad. Fat was bad for you, and eggs were bad for you, so no one was visiting the dairy. Now eggs are great for you, and we know dairy fat is good for you, and now we've got all kinds of milks. We've got almond milk and hemp milk and soy milk, which aren't really milk, but
right.
They don't even need to be refrigerated. But we put them there to make them seem more healthy, which is interesting. So the dairy has exploded. We've got all these kinds of butters now. We've got milks with various different proteins in them. So it's kind of astonishing to see the range of products that are now available to us.
And one thing that I've noticed, you know, we at Edible Communities are proponents of local, particularly local produce, but also local artisans. And while there are many issues with finding local, truly local produce, you know, we cannot find local mangoes in our supermarkets here. We have
really?
To go to markets. There's a complicated reason for that. Hmm. You know, however, it's the truth. They're from Mexico. They're from Haiti. Mm-hmm. So you have to go to farmers markets or your own backyard for mangoes here. In any event, what's happening is we're finding that local artisans, local chocolate makers, local bakers, one of our local bakers, Zach the Baker, for example, is now found in Whole Foods here, that there's a real effort on the part of, you know, large grocery chains here to look for that local touch.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And that's not because it's necessarily better. It's because people want it. It's perceived as a higher quality product, a fresher product, and it usually is. And I'm all for it. And I love local because I love supporting local people, and I like, and it probably is fresher. But they do it for, because it's also marketing. It may not be better. It's a complicated situation. Our food supply is not as simple as that. But it is perceived as fresher and better, and it usually is.
And isn't it a marketing? I mean, we like our local artisans.
Sure, that's marketing.
But it's in the news all over the place. The artisanal craze, which is somewhat maligned and made fun of, sometimes justifiably so, but that this is what younger people will be expecting in the future, too. Mm-hmm. So you're also investing in future shoppers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Again, I'm all for it. I think it makes this community stronger. It gives the grocery store a great product, and it's going to continue to grow, I think.
You make a very charming plea for bringing back beer cans that you have to open with those pointy can openers. What other, studying grocery stores of the past, what else would you like to see maybe come back?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I'd like to see things like non-homogenized milk, more, you know, some really fresh milk. Great cheeses, great raw milk cheeses and things like that. So I guess I'd want stuff that was made naturally in the, you know, before 1910, that kind of food. Anything that was sort of created or generated after the 1930s, especially after World War II, manufactured, is usually pretty bad for us. And we're finding out the long-term impact of that now, eating crappy food.
And you also tell the story of the woman who was in line in front of you who had the fat-free half and half.
Drives me crazy.
Yes.
Doesn't it?
Drives me
crazy. Sort of defeats the purpose.
You held your tongue for a while, but then had to speak, and I think I would have.
Yeah, the businesswoman, you know, businesswoman, smart woman, apparently, I mean, young professional, putting fat-free half and half. I asked her, I couldn't hold my tongue. Given that half and half is defined by the quantity of fat,
right? Specifically,
why are you buying that? She says, because it's fat free. I said, what do you think they replace the fat with? And she gave me this startled look, and then she picked up the box, kind of angry, the carton angrily, and read it and looked at me and said, skim milk and corn syrup. And she put it back down and she bought it anyway.
She bought it anyway.
She probably still does buy it because that fat is bad mantra is still so powerful. Yeah, what they did is they, because of what we asked for, what the consumer wanted, the dairy companies themselves took out the dairy fat, which is good for us, and replaced it with corn syrup, which is bad for us. So it epitomized for me the craziness of our food consciousness. We don't think. We need to think more. I want people to think about this. I don't want them to listen to the government. I don't even want them to listen to me. I want them to listen to themselves, to listen to their bodies, see what makes sense for them, because all our bodies are different. We all act and respond to foods differently. And so, think for yourself.
One thing we were talking about packaging a few moments ago, one thing that strikes me, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's is selling in bulk is sort of this, we just passed some legislation here locally in the municipalities banning plastic bags. Hmm. In other words, there's so much packaging now, and it's certainly mm-hmm. making me crazier. Mm-hmm. I don't, people put, a head of garlic in a plastic bag, put apples, I'm like, you can put them all in the same bag with nothing, and by the way, it should be a bag that you brought with you. And you can also buy stuff in bulk. Do you see trends toward in that direction going more universally? Because it's Whole Foods does it, I know.
Yeah, I do see that. I know people just drives people crazy from a common sense point of view. We talk about another thing to talk about is home meal replacements and the Blue Aprons and the HelloFresh. When you see them come in the mail, and they've got just tons of, it's like all packaging. And I think that people don't like that, and they don't want to see all that. We worry about all these plastic bottles, all this plastic in our environment. It's probably bad for us. It's probably toxic. And so we're paying attention to those things, but it's good that we're paying attention to them.
What is the alternative, though? Because we're so obsessed with everything is so packaged, the clamshell wrappers. I am paying a lot more attention to this now because I've suddenly reached a point where I don't want to have any more trash. I want a bag a week to put in the, and that's it. Because this stuff is ending up in the landfills, but plastic bottles for water. Everything seems to be encased in packaging. Is it because we consumers have asked for it? Are there safety? Why do the grocery stores feel the need? Is it more convenient? All of the above.
People, it's convenience and people expect it. A lot of people are sort of very, very germ phobic and are sort of weirdly germ phobic. They really want things separated.
It's a hygiene thing. But at the same time, I suspect that many of those people are also somewhat environmentally conscious and are horrified by all the landfill. So they don't realize they're creating the problem. I don't get water. They're giving it to us here. But I drink water out of the tap. I think you have to be in Flint, Michigan for me to really wonder about it. But what do you...
I don't know. We're at a book festival now, and there's tons of people wandering around and hundreds of authors, and they want to provide water, and water is critical. We haven't quite gotten to the point where we're all carrying around our plastic jugs and have regular filling stations, but we see more and more. Like at the airport, I see, here's a place to fill up your water bottle. I see that getting bigger and bigger. I hate these things. I don't like the look of them. I don't like the idea of all the waste. But right now, they're the most convenient option. And in a busy life, when you've got a lot going on, it's not high on my list to protest this by not drinking water and only carrying my bottle around.
Yeah. One thing that I've noticed that's springing up in the grocery stores with increasing frequency is the popularity of Instacart. And of course, with Amazon now, the delivery. And boy, when we deliver our magazines to some of the grocery stores here, more and more space is being delivered. I've seen the lockers, the Amazon lockers. This delivery phenomenon sort of seems... the opposite of enjoying your grocery store. It means you're not setting foot in it.
I'm hoping that we're going to see more of it, because what we're going to get is the commodity stuff, our LaCroix water, our pet food.
The heavy things.
The heavy stuff, the inconvenient stuff, the stuff that's commodity, that's the same no matter where you buy it. That stuff's all going to be delivered to you. And grocery stores are going to be going back to specialty purveyors of high-end products. I really hope that's what they become. I think the middle, the whole center of the store, that's the grocery department. That's quote-unquote grocery. All the stuff that won't go bad. First of all, you shouldn't be eating stuff that doesn't go bad.
Yeah.
The stuff that goes bad is the nutritious stuff. Stuff that doesn't go bad has no nutrition for it to go bad. All that's going to get delivered. That's going to empty out the center of the store. They're going to have to find someplace, something to replace it or shrink the store. We're going to shop for the good stuff, the great meat, the great fish, the great produce, the great fruits, the great cheeses, the great wines, the great beers, all the stuff that really makes us happy, certainly if you care about food and eating.
Although you do also... I can enjoy. I like going to New York City and going to Italy, for example, where they have the old school many stations, although I noticed they cut it back last time I was there. But there is kind of a, it's a trope even in a lot of American art of a certain time, these shiny aisles with all the colors of the products. And yet you mention a movie in which that was kind of a signifier of sterility.
Yeah, so, vast, dead consumer landscape, yes, full, right, of fake colors and badly illuminated.
Yeah.
Or overly illuminated.
So maybe in the future, how do you, beyond what you've just
told us. It's
going
to take some time because, you know, those Czech cereals and all those boxes of granola bars, which is all sugar, It's going to take a long time for those to go away. I mean, Cheerios may be bad for you in the long run. If you do it every day, first thing in the morning, odds, you know, there's evidence that it's terrible for you. But people don't like to change. They like their routine. They like their stuff. And it's going to take a long time for that kind of thing to go away.
Our final thoughts on the grocery store of the future 5 years from now. How do you see it?
The story of the grocery store from when I was growing up in the 1970s till today is one of increasing quality, increasing opportunity. We have just more and more abundance as people demand it. We have so much power as consumers. I just want people to remember that when you purchase something, when you buy something, you're asking for more of it. If you buy shitty food, you're asking for more of it. If you buy good food, you're asking for more of it. It will be filled. Those shelves will be filled with whatever you buy. And so if people realize that, then they realize that they can't really influence what's in the grocery store. And I think as we demand higher and higher quality, which we have been, grocery stores are going to be one of the great food sellers that we've ever known.
Okay, and I want to ask what your absolute favorite grocery store in the world is.
My favorite grocery store in the world is Heinen's grocery store, which I wrote about in my hometown of Cleveland, especially now the one that they opened in a bank building. Once this grand Beaux-Arts structure in the center of downtown Cleveland, this gorgeous cathedral that was once a cathedral of commerce, Cleveland Trust Bank, now it's a cathedral of food. And I like the symbolism of that, and I like what it says about our values and our community, so that the Heinen's in downtown Cleveland is my favorite supermarket in America.
I'm going to Cleveland. How about you?
Let's go. Thank you so much, Michael Ruhlman. Thank you, Christina Favretto. From Edible South Florida, this is Gretchen Schmidt, and thanks for listening to Tastes of the Tropics.
Thanks for listening to Tastes of the Tropics with Gretchen Schmidt and Christina Favretto on Edible Radio. For more information, visit ediblecommunities.com. This podcast is a production of Edible Radio, all rights reserved.